Hello, welcome to another episode of Dear Jane. I am your host today, Marcy Little. I'm joined by Scott Baker. Scott, how's it going?
Going well, Marcy. Always great to see you.
Good to see you too. We are living in strange times at the time of this recording. Some strange things are happening.
Really, I don't know that you have to really limit it to at the time of this recording, things are strange. I think there's a pretty good shelf life on that statement.
That's true. It just every week feels even more strange than the previous week. The DNC is going on right now. Crazy things are happening there. But I think today's guest is going to have a lot of good insight for people as they think about what's happening in Chicago.
Yeah, it's hard for me to think of anyone within the pro-life movement who is better at equipping us with a way to talk about it, the way to talk about life in just a compelling way. I love visiting with Scott Klusendorf. It's going to be fantastic.
Yep, it's going to be so great. Before I give our formal introduction to Scott Klusendorf, not to be confused with Scott Baker, Scott, could you tell us a little bit about today's sponsor, Choose Life Marketing?
Choose Life Marketing. So they are a group of all pro-life professionals. That's all they do. That's all they care about. They couldn't really talk to you about, you know, what's going on with nature or what's going on. They are passionate about pro-life issues. So if you're a pro-life organization and you're trying to get enhance your awareness a little bit, and you're finding a struggle, especially when you're trying to fight big tech and that sort of thing, they are experts at coming alongside you in that fight, fighting big tech and making sure that people are aware of your pro-life organization, your mission, and reaching the people that you need to reach. If you're a pregnancy center, reaching her, the abortion-minded woman. Lots of different creative ways to do it. You may have thought about all the ways. I bet you haven't. And if you get with them, ChooseLifeMarketing.com, they'll show you some ways that you can make sure that you're reaching people about your important message.
Awesome. Definitely check our friends out there. Our guest today is Scott Klusendorf. He is the president of the Life Training Institute and author of the book, The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. Scott is one of my favorite people to talk to listen to. As Scott Baker just mentioned a few minutes ago, he does a really good job of taking all of these pro-life facts and things that we know and we believe as pro-life people and helping us figure out how to communicate with others in a compelling and winsome way. So I'm excited for everyone to tune into today's episode with Scott Klusendorf. Thanks for joining us today, Scott, on Dear Jane.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Marcy.
Yep. I am curious because I first heard you speak in 2006 when I attended a 2-week worldview camp. And I...
And you let me on the show frankly, anyway?
Yeah. Well, it led to a very interesting conversation because I had never given much thought to how to defend my pro-life beliefs before that. And a couple of years after I heard you speak, I found myself on an airplane halfway across the world, actually headed to Ukraine, of all places, for a mission trip, and had a conversation with a guy on the plane. I don't even remember why or how the topic of abortion came up, but I remember I had tucked away all these little talking points from your presentation, and I was so excited that it worked, like, not in, like, a bad way, but, like, he stumped him. He didn't, you know, he knew all of his side's talking points, but didn't know how to defend any of them. So I am curious what some of the craziest pro-abortion arguments or sound bites are that you've ever heard.
Well, you know, when you think about how people attack the pro-life view, you can slot their objections into one of five bad ways people tend to argue. They either assume rather than argue, meaning they assume the unborn aren't human. So they say things like, why don't you respect a woman's right to choose? Why don't you trust women to make their own decisions? Why don't you respect her right to privacy? Things they would never say if we were arguing about killing 2-year-olds or 5-year-olds. They only argue that way with the unborn, which means they're assuming the unborn aren't human. The other thing they love to do is they attack rather than argue. So they'll say things like, well, you're a man. You have no right to speak on this issue. As if arguments stand or fall on the person making them rather than the merits of the argument. And so the sneaky side of me, Marcy, wants to look at someone who says, you're a man. You can't speak on this issue. I want to say, how do you know that I'm a man? Now, I don't do that, but I want right. to. And the reason is because they're missing the point entirely. Arguments stand or fall on their merits, not the person making them. Or they might assert rather than argue. They'll say things like, well, women have a fundamental right to an abortion without ever making an argument of where that right comes from, or clarifying what that right is grounded in. Where did that right come from in the first place, and why should we have it, and what exactly is the right you're talking about? So these are the three biggies. So you get these kinds of statements like, you're a man, or you just hate women, you're a misogynist. Well, maybe I am, maybe I'm not. How does that refute the actual pro-life argument I've made? And I think as pro-life apologists, it's very important we always keep the main thing the main thing. And that comes down to focusing on a very clear pro-life argument that goes like this. Premise one, it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Premise two, abortion intentionally kills innocent human beings. Conclusion, therefore abortion is wrong. Now that argument is either valid or invalid, sound or unsound. You can't dismiss it by attacking the person. So that's silly, but people do it all the time. You can't refute it by changing it or calling it a name and saying, well, that's just your religious view. Look, that's a change of topic. That's not refuting the argument. It's a lazy man's way out. So that's kind of what we see today. Almost everything is made personal rather than addressing the argument itself.
Is that how this debate and conversation has changed over the years, you think?
I think so, Scott. I think what's happened is instead of doing the hard work of engaging arguments, people are quite content with a short 5-second meme or a TikTok video that, you know, supposedly owns somebody without actually doing the thoughtful work of looking at the premises of an argument and asking, does the conclusion follow? Are those premises sound or unsound? Instead, it's a quick jab that we hope to get. And I think that comes from a culture whose primary epistemology, meaning how they learn about the world, comes down to cell phones, maybe television or computer screens, not book learning the way people learned maybe a century and a half ago. And that has affected our ability to follow arguments over the course of a long period of time or read lengthy books on subjects to gain real understanding.
That seems like it's had an impact on both sides of this, not just on people who tend to latch onto pro-abortion arguments, but people who tend to, who would identify on the pro-life side, but then they don't really know where to go from there. They don't know how to defend that position in as succinct and compelling a way as you just did.
No, I think you're right, Marcy. There's some bad pro-life arguments out there that we ought to steer clear of. Here's one. We probably aborted the doctor that would have cured cancer, or maybe we aborted the next Beethoven. That's a bad argument. We don't argue that abortion is wrong because it kills gifted people or, you know, future gifted people. We argue it's wrong because it intentionally kills an innocent human being, regardless his or her stage of development. We ought to keep our arguments clear and not make, you know, flashy stuff that really doesn't pan out in terms of following the logic of our own view.
So what do you make of this election season?
I think we're in for a bumpy ride, Scott. I think that there is a worldview problem we face that the pro-life movement is just waking up to. I think for decades, people have thought the primary problem facing the pro-life movement was marketing. We just need to make ourselves look more appealing to the culture, and there's a silent majority out there that will rally to our side. There is no silent majority. In fact, I think the majority of Americans hold to the very relativistic premises and worldview that make abortion plausible to most Americans. I don't think the majority of Americans are pro-life. I think they reject our claim that the unborn are members of the human family, and that cultural divide is very deep, And I don't think it's going to be easy to win elections moving forward. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I would love to be wrong on November 6th, but I fear that I'm right. And that is that this isn't a marketing problem we have in the political world. It's a worldview problem. And we're going to have to get very serious as pro-lifers at equipping people to understand our argument. We're going to have to get serious about equipping Christians who are predisposed to accept our view to know how to communicate that clearly stated pro-life argument to friends who are unchurched. If we don't do that, I think we lose the culture.
Why do you think so many Christians especially are not already on board with us? Like, they're predisposed to it, but they're not, we can't count on their vote on some of these crucial ballot initiatives.
You're exactly right. And to use an example from Summit, Marcy, where both of us have been involved over the last several years, I've been asking students at Summit before my talks on pro-life apologetics, how many of you before coming to Summit have heard a pro-life apologetics presentation at your church aimed at helping equip you to engage non-Christian friends on the issue? Now, out of 188 students present at each of the seven sessions we hold all summer long, each session it averages about 7 to 9 who raise their hands. And here's the thing. These are students coming from some of the best churches in the country, churches that are well attended, churches with big, influential youth groups, with churches that are, quite frankly, doing a lot of good in a lot of areas. But they haven't equipped their people to think biblically or persuasively on the pro-life issue. And then we wonder why Christians get confused on this. The culture's not telling them the truth about the issue. Our elected officials aren't telling them the truth. And now the church is silent? What are they going to believe? I mean, think about it. Kids are getting hundreds of hours a month of TikTok content, Twitter content, brief little sound bites that go against what Christians fundamentally believe. And against that backdrop, we say virtually nothing from the pulpit to equip them to think differently than the culture around them. I think that's why we have confusion with Christians.
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a second, and I agree with what you're saying. You're right. I've tried before to put myself in the position of some of these pastors. We just pointed out how we think a majority of Americans are not pro-life, so there's a chance I'm going to upset a large swath of my congregation. There's the whole 501c3 thing that is, you know, the misunderstood in many, many ways. Yep. I mean, what would be your encouragement to them with some of these hesitations?
Well, if you preach Jesus is the only way to salvation and all other world religions are false, you will get people upset with you. That's going to happen. There are parts of the Christian worldview that are inherently divisive, and we can't change that. Now, we should not be unduly offensive, but there are parts of the gospel you just have to convey as is because you have no wiggle room with it. Look, Jesus either was the Messiah or he wasn't. If he was the Messiah, Christians are right and every other worldview is wrong. If he's not the Messiah, we're wrong, they're right. And the bottom line is we can't avoid the conflict or the offense. And when you tell people that abortion is objectively wrong, you are correct. You will offend some people. And my answer to that is a pastor's job is not to respect a consensus in his church. It's to forge a consensus along the lines of a biblical worldview. That's his job. Yeah, he'll pay a price for that, but he's going to pay that price whether he tells the truth on abortion, salvation, discipleship, tithing, pick any point of Christian doctrine you want. There are going to be people upset that you state the truth clearly and objectively. So I would say to that pastor, look, God isn't going to judge you based on how popular you are. He's going to judge you by, did you feed my sheep? That's going to be the standard. And as a colleague of mine has put it, I fear that some of our churches have become so seeker-friendly, they've become believer-worthless. We're not equipping our own people to go out and share not only biblical worldview truths, but the gospel itself. As for a C3, and that's a great question, Scott, I'm not asking pastors to endorse candidates from the pulpit, but I think pastors misunderstand the law on this. You are allowed to do voter education. You're allowed to do something like, I think, up to 15% of your operational activity can be politically motivated. But I would also say to that pastor who thinks politics is just dirty, I don't even want to deal with it, two things I would say there, Scott. Number one, our biblical worldview applies to all of life, not just some areas to the exclusion of others. It applies to the whole thing. And that means Christians should be taking a biblical worldview into the voting booth. But secondly, I would add this, that when you as a pastor tell the truth about abortion, you're communicating morality, not just politics. I think some people think, oh, abortion's a political issue. It's also a moral issue because it's about loving our unborn neighbor and not standing idly by while they're butchered. So I think that we need to be shepherds who convey a love for our unborn neighbor, and that is every bit as much a moral issue as it is a political one.
I think one of the most sinister things the other side has done in terms of shaping how people think about this is convincing everyone that this is a political issue, because most people are not excited to jump in and get political. And, you know, the most political they want to do is maybe show up to vote, but not during the primaries, not to, like, I'll show up every 4 years in November and vote.
Right.
How do we reframe that for people? There are so many opportunities even outside of the political realm for us to love our unborn neighbor. How can we help broaden people's perspective that this is not just a political issue?
Well, let me take that question in two parts. First of all, I think we have to help our fellow churchgoers understand that Christians have an objective every time they step into the voting booth, and it is this. It's not a mere partisan divide in our minds. It comes down to how can we as Christians who are biblically grounded limit evil and promote the good insofar as possible, given the current election cycle and the restraints it deals us. We cannot always get the perfect. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was very clear that politics is always the art of the possible. We're never going to have perfect candidates. And some people say, well, I just refuse to vote for the lesser of two evils. I think they need to reframe that, as our colleague Kevin Bywater has pointed out. We're not voting for the lesser of two evils when we enter the voting booth. We're voting to lessen evil. And that's our job as Christians, is to lessen evil and promote the good insofar as possible, given the cycle we're in and the restraints that are upon us in that given cycle. So sometimes we may not be able to get, for example, ultimate protection for all unborn humans, but we can save 70% of them with a bill that incrementally limits the evil done. We ought to vote for that. Or it may be the case that in our state there's a bill that would put handcuffs on pro-life pregnancy centers and restrict the work they're able to do, like saying they've got to advertise for abortion or refer clients to abortion clinics, like happened in California several years ago. Well, you have a duty to go out and try to limit that evil that's done. And God is not going to hold us guiltless if we just step out of this. I'm thinking, for example, of Proverbs 24, where we're told you're not going to be able to claim on Judgment Day that you didn't see the evil around you and you were unaware of it. The Lord is really clear. No, you knew you had a duty to do something. You didn't do it. And we'll be held accountable for that. So I'm always about lessening evil and promoting good insofar as possible. And I think if we can reframe it that way to our fellow churchgoers who tend to be politically averse, say, listen, we're not asking you to become a partisan here. We're just asking you to lessen evil and promote good insofar as we can as believers. That's all we're asking. We're not telling you that you have to go out there and campaign for this candidate or that candidate, though I wish some of us would, but we just want you to do the minimum here, which is, hey, I'm going to love my neighbor by lessening evil and promoting good as much as I'm able.
One of the traps I think we fall into in the pro-life movement, it drives me nuts, is, well, candidate A, I only agree with about 80% of their stance on life, or maybe all of the issues above, or let's just take the abortion issue specifically. they don't feel exactly the way I do, so I'm not going to support them. And that is just really a slippery slope.
It really is. And there are some pro-lifers out there known as abolitionists who say that if you vote for any candidate or any bill that is not an absolute ban on all abortions, you are a compromiser and your incrementalism is intrinsically evil. But the truth is, Scott, Christians have always had to live with a troubling tension between principle and what's morally feasible given the culture and political cycle we happen to be in. For example, if you were a Christian in 1776 and you opposed slavery, would you have voted for the Declaration of Independence even though the language prohibiting slavery and condemning it was stripped out of it so the southern states could be brought into the Union? If you say you would vote for that anyway, then you've just rejected the premise that incrementalism is intrinsically evil. But I think we can go even further. Even abolitionists who introduce a complete ban on abortion in one state, but not in all of them, they're practicing geographical incrementalism. If they introduce a bill that bans abortion but leaves IVF embryos unprotected, they're practicing strategic incrementalism. My point is we can't help but be incrementalist. And here's where incrementalism becomes compromise. When you have the political power to protect all unborn humans, but you won't do it. And you punt to incrementalism so that you can keep abortion somewhat legal for your own self-interest. It would be like some of the parliamentarians in William Wilberforce's day that wanted an incremental end to slavery when they had the votes to ban the slave trade outright. And the reason why they wanted to go slow and go incremental, they wanted to continue to profit from slavery for a few more years. That's evil. But if you don't have the votes to protect all unborn humans, you certainly should vote to protect as many as you can. And I'm unwilling to sacrifice children's lives that can be saved through incremental legislation, holding out hope for an idealized future that may be decades yet to come. I think we need to save the lives we can right now and always keep coming back for more. Never stop till all are protected.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I think the other side does incrementalism really well. I'm thinking about just in my lifetime, in the last 25, 30 years, they went from safe, legal, and rare to now, at the time of this recording,
shout
there's a
your
Planned
abortion.
Parenthood bus. Yeah. Shout your abortion, but there's also a Planned Parenthood bus outside of the DNC offering free abortions. Like, that's how far that side of things has come. But they didn't start in the 1990s with shout your abortion.
No.
They started with, safe, legal, rare. And before that, it was, this really is a decision between a woman and her doctor. So they've led the American people along. And they've been willing to wait and play the long game. And I think our side is bad at playing the long game.
I think you're exactly right, Marcy. And our side responded very poorly to the safe, legal, and rare rhetoric of Bill Clinton in the early 1990s. Our side should have asked this question and pressed the question relentlessly. Why should abortion be rare? Make them answer that question. Instead, you know what our side did in the 1990s? We had a whole paradigm shift that said, let's quit talking about abortion. We've already won the debate over the status of the unborn. What we need to do is demonstrate that abortion is not in the self-interest of women. In other words, we shifted from the objective truths, what is abortion, to subjective ones about women's own felt self-interest and needs. Well, that just laid the groundwork for the relativism we have today, where now you can just shout your abortion, and who are you to judge anybody who does?
You know, as I think back to what we were talking about, you mentioned how, and I think you're probably right, how most Americans are pro-choice, or at least they certainly consider themselves that. There's no question about that. And then I think about these state constitutional amendment, these ballots that are these fights that are going on in a handful of states. Is there just no hope since we're in the minority, or you know, give me something here, Scott? I'm clinging by a string.
Yeah, well, you're not wrong, Scott. Look, we're 0-8 in states where abortion has been put directly to the public for a vote since Roe overturned, and that's because we face this worldview struggle. Now, Florida is a state we may yet win, and there's a reason for that. There's a 60% threshold there that the other side has to get. They've got to get 60% of the Floridian public to agree that abortion should be a constitutional right. And the governor is going to weigh in on this. He hasn't started yet. We are weighing in with ads that we have produced that we think will be very effective at reaching Christians and encouraging them to go vote no against this. I also think that long term, we shouldn't be surprised with what we're seeing. When you poke the bear, the empire will strike back. You know, it's going to happen. And they have much more in the way of resource banks than we do. We are the, you know, outnumbered minority, the little guy, okay? So there's going to be a fight. We always knew there would be. But long term, I think culture is on a collision course with itself. On one hand, we got people saying that you can make women up to be anything they want to be. A man can say, I'm really a woman trapped in a man's body. On the other hand, they're arguing that women have an objective, fundamental right to an abortion. But wait a minute. So the right to abortion is objective, but women are not? I mean, this is the crazy stuff we're headed on. And I do think that reality eventually comes around. And I think if I'm going to give you hope, Scott, it would be this. Our primary objective right now should be to preserve the clear and objective case for the pro-life cause. Make the case objectively and clear and preserve it during these dark times for a time when society begins to reevaluate itself. You know, you think back to the Dark Ages. The Islamic forces were running roughshod over Europe with the Crusades, and it was monks who hid Western learning. They preserved it. They hid manuscripts. They hid books so that we still have Aristotle to read, for example, and Plato, and certain biblical texts. It was the faithful work of monks who hid learning and protected it for a day when it could one day come back. And I think pro-lifers, although we're not going to hide arguments, we certainly need to be clear on them and keep stating them over and over again and making it clear we're not going to go away. We're going to stay in the game. You can beat us at the ballot box, but they haven't been able to put us away, Scott. That's what I would say is hopeful. Think about it. They've had the media, most of the time the government. They've had the federal courts. They've had the state courts. They've had education, entertainment, media. I mean, they've had every cultural microphone on their side, and yet the pro-life movement is still here. They have not been able to put this issue to bed, so to speak, like it has been put to bed in places like Europe and parts of Asia. We are still a movement to be reckoned with, even though we are small. And that's where I come back to hope. If we can just do a little bit better job making our case, making it clear what we believe, and equipping others to do it, I do think this one day is a winnable fight.
All right, I'm fired up now. Let's go.
Yeah, ready to go. Shot in the arm. Yeah.
Well, let me plug my book now. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, blah, yeah. No, tell us about your book. Tell us about what you do, Scott, and where people can find you online.
Sure. If you want to begin equipping yourself to defend life, I do commend to your reading the second edition of my book, The Case for Life. It's 60% thicker than the original version, and it's brought up to date what the reality is in a post-Roe world. So that's why I wrote it. What's that?
I'm also 60% thicker than the original version, but that's.
Aren't we all? Yeah, that's good. We all are. Yep, that delay there kind of had me lose that joke. But I would start with that. If they want to follow my podcast, they can go to scottklusendorf.com, or if they want to follow us at Life Training Institute, prolifetraining.com. Each of these sites will give you resources for equipping your pro-life view and making your arguments effective.
Yep. Thanks so much, Scott. Happy to have you here with us today. Thanks for giving us that hopeful take there at the end and encouraging us in the work that we're doing.
We're not done, folks. We're not done. It's dark right now, but stay at your post, keep engaging, and let's wait for the favorable time I'm praying the Lord will yet grant us.
Thanks again for listening to Dear Jane.
You can follow along every day on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and X. And make sure you also are subscribed so you never miss an episode on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. Ring that bell so you're notified and you never miss an episode.